Welcome to the deep dive. We take your sources, unpack them, and give you back clear, actionable knowledge. Today, we're diving into something that honestly might be the deciding factor in your quality of life. We're talking about crucial conversations, those moments, you know, high stakes, high emotions. They really shape your career, your relationships, maybe even your health. So you sent us a stack exploring high stakes communication. Our mission today: define what a crucial conversation actually is, figure out why we usually mess them up.
Often spectacularly.
Right. And then crucially, get into the first couple of foundational skills. We need to stop just sort of stumbling through these things.
It's so important because people often misunderstand what we mean by crucial. It's not just any tough chat. The research defines it very specifically. It's a discussion where three things are happening at once. One, the stakes are high. Two, opinions differ. And three, emotions are running strong. All three have to be present. These are the conversations most people just, well, avoid. Like negotiating a raise or giving difficult feedback or dealing with conflict. They set the direction for so much.
Oh, I know that feeling, that tension. It's like, remember that source example?
Yeah.
The neighbors arguing over the fence.
The 3 inches?
Exactly. 3 inches of property line. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it goes from a fence discussion to like insults about someone's kidneys, threats of lawsuits. It just explodes.
That escalation, that sort of disproportionate reaction, that's a classic sign of a failed crucial conversation. Either we avoided it till it blew up or we just handled it terribly in the moment.
Okay, so let's talk about that avoidance. Why does getting better at this matter so much beyond just feeling awkward? The sources claim something pretty bold, that failing these affects almost everything.
It really does seem to. The evidence is quite compelling. Take the workplace, for instance. It's fascinating, actually. Well, for years, researchers looked for the key to organizational success. They thought it had to be, you know, fancy performance management systems or brilliant strategy or the perfect structure. But what they found consistently was that success, productivity, speed, even safety, it didn't really depend on those formal things. It depended almost entirely on whether employees could and would hold crucial conversations face to face.
Wow. So it's not about having the perfect system on paper.
Yep.
It's about people actually being skilled enough and brave enough to talk to each other directly when things go wrong.
Exactly. We see it in studies of really high-performing companies. A lot of them had surprisingly simple or even few formal processes.
Oh.
They worked because if someone missed a deadline or dropped the ball, it wasn't always the manager who stepped in. Often it was a colleague. They'd just talk about it directly, effectively, quickly.
So accountability becomes peer-to-peer.
That's it. Fueled by dialogue skills.
Right.
It's about everyone holding everyone else accountable in a healthy way.
That's a huge shift. Puts a lot of responsibility on individual interactions, not just top-down management. But, okay, the sources mentioned even more shocking personal consequences.
Yeah, this is where it gets really startling. It connects directly to our safety, even our physical health. Think about relationships.
Okay.
Violence, tragically, often doesn't come out of nowhere. It frequently follows long periods of silence. Unresolved issues just fester and build up until they explode.
Yeah.
Over half the people convicted of violent crimes, they're first-time offenders, attacking people they know, friends, family. Often, it seems, they just didn't know how to speak up about the problem,
right.
So things escalated to force.
Incredibly sobering. Dialogue skills as a factor in preventing violence.
It's a direct link. And then there's the physical health angle, which most people find hard to believe at first.
Right, the immune system connection.
Exactly. Groundbreaking studies tracked couples over decades. And the ones who consistently failed at their crucial conversations, they had measurably weaker immune systems than the couples who found ways to work through conflict effectively.
So the stress of unresolved conflict literally wears down your body's defenses.
It appears so. The chronic stress takes a toll. And maybe the most dramatic finding: there's a study with malignant melanoma patients.
Yeah.
Some were taught basic communication skills, how to talk more openly, connect better. Others weren't. The group that got the communication training, they had a 2/3 decrease in the death rate compared to the untrained group over the study period.
2/3 just from learning communication skills.
It suggests a powerful link. Improving your ability to dialogue, to connect, might actually correspond to a significant decrease in mortality risk, at least in that context. Long-term inability to talk things through seems genuinely toxic.
Okay, that alone is reason enough to ditch the passive-aggressive emails and actually talk to someone.
You'd think so.
So that leads us straight to the next big question. If the stakes are this high, health, relationships, career success, why are we so bad at it? Why do we default to avoiding these talks or messing them up so badly when we try?
Well, the short, maybe slightly brutal answer from the research is when conversations turn crucial, we're basically designed wrong for them.
Designed wrong? That sounds fatalistic. Like, if it's biology, are we just stuck? Is it hopeless without, I don't know, years of therapy?
Huh. It's not hopeless, but it is an uphill battle. That's why the skills are so vital. See, when those strong emotions kick in, fear, anger, whatever our bodies react based on millennia of genetic programming, survival mode.
Fight or flight.
Exactly. Flying fists and fleet feet, as the sources put it. Adrenaline floods your system. Blood gets diverted away from the parts of your brain you need for nuanced thinking, for complex reasoning, for persuasion.
And goes where instead?
To your large muscles. You're getting ready to physically fight or run away. So right when you need to be calm, creative, patient, your body makes you, frankly, dumber, faster, and more rigid.
Which is the exact opposite of what you need for a difficult conversation.
Precisely. And then there's the other problem. These conversations often pop up unexpectedly.
Yeah, they blindside you.
Right. No warning, no therapist magically appearing at your elbow. You're just suddenly in it. High stakes, high emotions, and you're full of adrenaline, probably falling back on whatever bad habits or poor examples you've learned over the years.
No wonder we say things we regret 5 minutes later.
It's almost inevitable without conscious skill. And this leads to the real psychological trap. We end up acting in ways that are completely self-defeating. Our go-to strategies, usually silence or some form of verbal violence, actually prevent us from getting what we truly want.
Ugh, that loop sounds painfully familiar. I think everyone recognizes that.
Think about that roommate example from the sources. Terry, the clothes borrower.
Right. Where's your stuff without asking?
Okay. So what do you really want? You want the borrowing to stop, probably. And you likely want to keep living together reasonably peacefully, right?
Yeah, both things.
But what do? Often you avoid talking about it directly. You drop hints. You leave passive-aggressive post-it notes. Maybe you hide your favorite clothes.
Guilty as charged, probably, in some past life.
Huh. So your chosen method avoidance, passive aggression, it actually makes the relationship worse. It guarantees the conflict doesn't get resolved. You chose avoidance hoping to keep the peace, but your actions destroyed the peace anyway. That's the self-defeating cycle.
Okay, so breaking that cycle.
Mm.
It isn't about figuring out how to fix Terry. It starts with fixing my own reaction first.
Absolutely. That's the core insight. To master these crucial conversations, we need to steer the interaction away from unhealthy patterns, silence, or violence, and towards what the sources call the pool of shared meaning.
The pool of shared meaning.
Yeah, it's basically the space where everyone involved feels safe enough to contribute all their relevant thoughts, feelings, and experiences. It's where synergy happens, where the best ideas and solutions emerge.
Okay, sounds good. How do we get there?
The very first step is internal. It's foundational skill one. Start with heart. It means getting yourself right before or as you open your mouth. It's about making sure your motive is in the right place, focused on mutual understanding, solving the problem, achieving the best outcome for everyone involved.
Okay, but when I feel attacked or under pressure, my goal instantly shifts. It goes from, let's solve this, to I need to win or I need to prove them wrong. How do you even catch that happening in the heat of the moment?
That's the tricky part, that adrenaline spike. It often triggers the subconscious shift. We stop aiming for good results and start pursuing these secondary, often unhelpful goals.
Hmm.
Saving face, being right, punishing the other person.
All right.
Starting with heart means consciously pausing, even for a split second, maybe internally, maybe literally stepping away for a moment and asking yourself those crucial questions. What do I really want here? For myself, for the other person, for the relationship. Remember Greta, the CEO example?
The one getting called out about the expensive office furniture while she was demanding budget cuts?
Exactly. A manager, Mark, nervously brings up this rumor. $150,000 on her office redo. Greta feels instantly defensive, attacked. Her gut reaction, her initial goal is probably something like, I'm going to put this guy in his place. How dare he?
Totally. Win the fight. Defend her authority.
Right. But she managed to catch herself. She asked that question. What do I really want? And she realized what she truly wanted was transparency, trust, and for the company to succeed with its cost cutting. Her personal defensiveness wasn't serving that larger goal.
So she shifted her focus.
She did. And because her motive shifted back to the shared goal, she could apologize for not checking the cost herself and commit right there to slashing the project budget or even canceling it. That pivot, driven by starting with heart, likely saved the conversation and rebuilt trust.
That pause, that motive check. Is key. And it also helps us avoid what the source is called the sucker's choice, right?
Oh, the sucker's choice is maybe the biggest trap. It's that false dilemma, the either thinking that paralyzes us. Like,
I can either tell my boss the truth about this problem, or I can keep my job.
Exactly. Or I can be honest with my friend about how they hurt my feelings, or I can keep the friendship. I have to choose between winning this argument or maintaining the relationship. The trap is believing you have to choose between only those two, usually bad, options. Successful dialogue hinges on refusing that choice. You have to look for the and.
Okay, looking for the and. But when I'm feeling trapped and defensive, my brain isn't exactly firing on all creative cylinders. How do you actually find that and solution?
It's a conscious effort. First step, recognize you're stuck in an everer. Notice the options you're giving yourself usually boil down to silence or violence in some form. Second step, clarify what you don't want, e.g., I don't want to ruin the relationship, I don't want to get fired. Third, and this is key, clarify what you do want, e.g., I want to be honest about the mistake, I want to maintain respect. Then you force your brain to get creative by combining them. How can I be completely honest about this issue and ensure my boss understands my commitment? Or how can I share my feelings with my friend and strengthen our relationship? Asking the and question opens up possibilities beyond the initial sucker's choice.
So you're forcing yourself to brainstorm a third, better option instead of just accepting the two bad ones.
Precisely. It breaks you out of that fight or flight limited thinking.
Okay, so we've got skill one. Start with heart. Fix your motive. But even with the best intentions, emotions can still hijack the conversation. You mentioned people saying, he made me mad. The sources push back on that, don't they? Asking, did they make you mad or did you?
Exactly. That brings us to foundational skill two, master my stories. And the core idea here is, frankly, revolutionary for many people. Others don't make you feel things. You make you feel things based on the stories you tell yourself about what they did.
Whoa. Okay, that's a big claim. Unpack that. How do I make myself mad?
The sources use a model called the path to action. It shows how we get from observing something to doing something. It goes like this. You see or hear something someone does. That's the objective facts.
Okay, just the facts.
Right. But that action doesn't directly cause your feeling. In between the see, hear, and the feel, you tell a story. This story is your interpretation, your judgment, your conclusion about why they did what they did or what it means. So, example. A coworker interrupts you in a meeting. That's the see here.
Okay.
If you then think, he interrupted me because he thinks my idea is stupid and he wants to shut me down, that interpretation, that assumption about his motive, that's the story you just added.
Ah, I see. The because part is the story.
Exactly. And that story is what generates the feeling maybe anger, defensiveness, insecurity, which then drives your action. Maybe you shut down, silence, or maybe you lash back. Violence.
And this storytelling must happen almost instantly, right?
Yeah.
Because when I feel that flash of anger, it doesn't feel like I constructed a narrative. It just feels like, well, he was being dismissive. The story feels like a fact.
That speed is precisely the danger. Especially when we feel threatened or vulnerable, we spin these stories incredibly fast. They feel absolutely real, like objective truth.
Okay, so if we need to get control of our emotions, we need to get control of these stories. The sources mention specific types of unhelpful stories we tell.
Yes. To justify our own potentially unhelpful reactions, our silence or violence, we often rely on three particularly clever stories, as the sources call them. They're clever because they let us feel okay about our own bad behavior. They get us off the hook.
All right, what are they?
First is the victim story. It's not my fault. Here, we paint ourselves as innocent sufferers. We emphasize our noble motives and ignore any part we might have played in the problem. I only snapped at him because I've been carrying the whole team's workload and nobody appreciates it.
Okay, casting myself as the martyr.
Yep.
Got it. What's next?
Second is the villain story. This is where we do the opposite to the other person. We assume the absolute worst motives and exaggerate their flaws. They aren't just late. They're completely disrespectful and lazy. They didn't just disagree. They're a manipulative control freak. We turn normal, flawed people into monsters.
Which, conveniently, justifies our own anger or withdrawal.
Perfectly. And the third one is the helpless story. There's nothing I can do. Here, we convince ourselves we're powerless to act constructively. We often frame it as having only bad options, back to the sucker's choice. I had to yell, otherwise he'd just walk all over me. Or, there's no point talking to her, she'll never listen anyway.
Victim, villain, helpless. Okay. I could definitely see how those stories fuel negative emotions and lead straight away from the productive conversation we wanted back when we started with heart.
They are the engine of unhealthy dialogue.
So let's say I catch myself. I realize I'm furious because I'm running a major villain story about my coworker. What's the practical step-by-step process to regain control? How do I challenge that story?
It involves consciously retracing that path to action we talked about, but in reverse, and questioning each step. There are basically four steps to get back to objectivity. One, notice your behavior. Am I currently acting out in silence or violence? Am I withdrawing, masking my feelings? Or am I trying to control, label, attack? You have to spot the symptom first.
Okay, identify the unhealthy action.
Two, get in touch with your feelings. What specific emotions are driving this behavior? Is it anger, fear, hurt, embarrassment? Name the feeling.
Right, feel the feeling.
Three, analyze your story. What story am I telling myself that's creating this feeling? This is where you identify which of the clever stories, victim, villain, helpless, you might be caught in.
Challenge the narrative.
And four, this is the crucial deconstruction step. Get back to facts. What objective evidence do I actually have to support this story? Separate the observable facts, what you saw or heard, from the subjective conclusions and judgments, the story.
Okay, let's try the roommate example again with those four steps. Step one, notice behavior. I'm leaving passive-aggressive notes, silence masking.
Good.
Step two, identify feeling. I'm feeling resentful, maybe annoyed.
Okay.
Step three, analyze story. The story is, Terry is selfish and deliberately disrespects my stuff. She doesn't care about anyone but herself. That sounds like a villain story.
Definitely leans that way. Now, step four.
Step four, get back to facts. Okay, the facts are, Terry wore my sweater once last week without asking, and she left a dirty bowl in the sink yesterday. That's it. The rest, selfish, deliberately disrespects, doesn't care. That's all the story I added.
See, when you strip it down to facts, the emotional intensity often decreases. The story was fueling the strong resentment. The facts are much less inflammatory. They point to a problem that needs addressing, yes, but not necessarily a character assassination.
And from that calmer place, based on facts, I can then choose a more constructive action, like actually talking to Terry, instead of just stewing or leaving notes.
Exactly. You break the self-defeating loop by mastering your story. You realize you choose the story, and therefore you can choose your emotions and your resulting behavior, making it possible to get back to that pool of shared meaning.
That feels really empowering, actually. So just to recap the foundation here, it's about focusing inward first. Master your heart, get your motives right, and master your stories, manage your emotions by challenging your interpretations.
Those two are the bedrock. All the other dialogue skills build upon that internal foundation. Get yourself right first. And please remember, these are skills. They aren't personality traits. They are observable, learnable behaviors. It might seem daunting, but even small improvements, like finding a way to talk effectively about just one really tough, high-stakes topic that you've been avoiding.
Yeah.
That one shift can ripple outwards and genuinely impact almost everything, your work, your relationships, and as we've discussed, maybe even your long-term health.
The stakes are just so incredibly high, from the boardroom all the way down to our immune systems. Mm-hmm. It's kind of mind-blowing when you put it all together.
It really is. So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. As you go about your day, reflect on the stories you tell yourself. Think about the conversations you had, or maybe the ones you avoided.
Yeah.
Ask yourself, which specific crucial conversation, if I could hold it effectively or just handle it a bit better, which one holds the potential to not just solve a problem, but maybe even in the long run, strengthen my well-being, my health, my quality of life.
Find that one conversation.
Find that one. That's probably the one that deserves your energy and these skills the most.
Powerful stuff. That's our deep dive for today. Hopefully you feel better equipped now to start with heart and master your stories in those crucial conversations ahead.